Topic 1, Invasion of Privacy, Part 2. This is the eighth in a series of civil liberties programs produced by the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director. In the first program on invasion of privacy, we heard a discussion by Professor Alan F. Weston, Professor of Public Law of Columbia University, on the latest techniques and the latest technology in wiretapping and electronics eavesdropping, and some of the problems this has created by their use by public agencies and private industry. Following this talk, MCLU put together a panel discussion of experts on some of the various problems in this field. Tonight we're going to hear from Dr. David K. Berninghausen, Director of the University of Minnesota Library School, on the literature in the field of invasion of privacy. Also, we will hear from Professor John R. Ellingston, a criminologist at the University of Minnesota Law School, on the invasion of privacy by our social and welfare agencies. And now, Dr. David K. Berninghausen of the University Library School on the literature available in the field of invasion of privacy.
Is our privacy being invaded unreasonably? Do the public want to know too much about our private affairs? Is it any different in the city and the country? Herb Schreiner once told about his hometown in Indiana and explained how small it was by saying, well, there everybody knows what everybody else is doing. People only buy the paper to try to find out which ones got caught at it. Do we have a right of privacy? For one illustration, when my telephone rings, I have a habit of picking up the phone and answering with one long word. It's too long, too much of a mouthful to say, this is Professor Berninghausen speaking, so I just answer Berninghausen, and then I wait to see what the caller has to say, see what will happen. Last week, we had company and the telephone rang, and I gave my usual answer and waited to see what would happen. And the first remark was, is that you, Dave? I said, yes, and waited. Well, Dave, a friend of ours, mutual friend, suggested that I call you and try to arrange an appointment to get together to talk over a problem. Yes. Well, Dave, I would really like to come over and see you. When would be a convenient time? Well, what did you want to see me about? Well, Dave, this friend of yours suggested that maybe you need to buy a little more insurance. I have my standard procedure when a telephone solicitor calls. As soon as I identify the nature of the call, I quickly say, drop dead and put up the receiver. But in this case, he really was doing such a novel job of it that I held on, and in about 2 minutes, he used Dave about 10 times. I never did say drop dead this time. There's no effective protection against the telephone solicitor. You can, if you request it, get an unlisted number. You may have to pay more for it in some communities. One woman who came home from the hospital after having a baby complained that she was pestered 8 times in 3 hours by different salesmen on the telephone, and finally she hung up and called the telephone company and demanded an unlisted number. In some large cities today, 15% of the telephones are unlisted. If you want to read only one book about this, I would suggest Vance Packard's well-indexed volume, The Naked Society. It's probably the most comprehensive and all-round book on the subject. It is popular in style. And to give you an idea of what it's about, and also to introduce a good many subjects, good many questions, which I hope our panel will consider, are these invasions of privacy? Let's look at the first page. By telescoping time a bit, let's look in on a reasonably successful family in a typical city of the Land of Liberty 1964. Mom is at the department store trying on a new dress in the dressing room. A closed-circuit TV camera hidden behind a mesh screen is recording her moves to make certain she does not pocket any of the store's merchandise. Dad is at a conference table in his office talking to a group of colleagues about the operations of his department. The colleague sitting next to him is an undercover agent hired from a nationwide detective agency by the president of Dad's company to keep tabs on the performance of key subordinates. Elsewhere, an investigator is on the telephone chatting with Dad's banker about the sizes of Dad's bank account and any outstanding loans. It seems that Dad recently applied for an insurance policy on his personal property. Son John, just out of college, is seated in a chair with a pneumatic tube strapped across his chest and an electrode taped to his palm. John has just applied for a job as a sales representative for an electronics concern. He is now undergoing the usual lie detector test to probe his honesty, his possibly dangerous habits, and his manliness. Meanwhile, an investigator is talking to one of John's erstwhile professors concerning any political opinions the boy may have expressed during class discussions. Daughter Mary, sweet girl, is still only a sophomore in high school. She's still in the classroom, struggling with a 250-item questionnaire. It asks her to reveal whether her parents seem to quarrel a lot, whether they have ever talked to her about sex, and whether she's worried about menstrual disorders. Vance Packard elaborates on these and various other devices used in a variety of situations which he feels destroy our privacy. For example, have you ever wondered how the direct mail businesses get your name to send you the tons of junk mail that you get? In 1963, the Wall Street Journal carried a headline, "Name selling booms as male advertisers seek likely prospects." And Vance Packard says that this business today of selling your names is a $400 million a year business. The Diners Club, for example, will sell you its list of 680,000 members for about $17,000. There just isn't any way you can keep your name off the direct mail advertising lists. However, last Thursday, day before yesterday, my mailbox had 10 pieces, some of them rather large pieces of junk mail in it. I took great delight in acting upon one of the suggestions I found in one of these books. One of these envelopes had a return envelope in it which said that the addressee would pay for the cost of the postage. And the suggestion was that I put a piece of the literature which I had received back in the envelope and post the envelope, and it will thus cost the company 5 cents, and they won't even know who did it. If we all did this all the time, we couldn't stop it, of course, but it might cut down on the profits. To what extent is our privacy illegitimately or unfairly being invaded? Well, I'm citing a number of possibilities for our panel to consider. Now, if you have read Vance Packard, perhaps you don't really need to read Myron Brenton's The Privacy Invaders. Some of it is the same stuff. Some of the same people are discussed in it. However, Brenton goes into much more detail about credit investigations, how they look into your private affairs the minute you apply for credit or a loan, and also the insurance investigators. And as with all of these, most of these cases, in up to a point, we can hardly quarrel with the necessity for some kinds of investigation. However, many times the results of the investigation are not kept confidential, and it is at this point that these authors usually feel our privacy is being invaded. Brenton talks about the banks who talk too much about your income, the behavioral scientists, the employers with their lie detector tests, psychiatric interviews, neighborhood checks, and security clearances. And let's just talk a little bit about the neighborhood checks. This is the phenomenon known, what's called neighborhood checks. A company wants to investigate, it might be insurance, credit, or anything else, and they send investigators around your neighborhood asking your neighbors if they know any dirt about you. Each day, thousands of private investigators ring thousands of telephone doorbells and ask about you. They usually get some answers. Doesn't matter whether the answers are true, but they have to get some answers. I do like the letter that appeared in the Saturday Evening Post in 1963. Presumably an elderly lady wrote in and said that in her day, people didn't ask questions and pry so much. She felt that fine old American expression, emphatic and with an element of dignity, that saying, "It's none of your business," has just disappeared from our lexicon. As Aldous Huxley suggests, most of us would probably find Jefferson's comment about eternal hostility toward all forms of tyranny over the mind of man, or Patrick Henry's "Give me liberty or death," rather quaint. Instead, he says we're more apt to demand, "Give me television and hamburgers, but don't bother me about any responsibilities of liberty." And some of the investigators are expected by their employers to produce at least 10% derogatory reports. Because, of course, if they fail to turn up any bad reports, the customer might decide that these investigations were unnecessary. Brenton also goes into great detail about the executives who spy on employees, tapping telephones, hiring undercover agents, planting microphones and two-way mirrors in company washrooms. The insurance investigators are discussed in great detail in this book. The corporations which play the deadly game of industrial espionage. This is one company trying to find out about another company's secrets, which I guess could be quite a deadly game. For a more penetrating discussion of this question, I like Morris Ernst's and Alan Schwartz's Privacy, The Right to be Let Alone. This is chiefly a recital of legal cases tracing the story of this peculiarly modern legal concept and dilemma, the right of the individual to be let alone versus the right of the public to be informed and conceivably enlightened. Ernst and Schwartz feel that our privacy is violated whenever something unique about an individual, his face, his name, or even his dog's picture, is taken by someone else without his consent and revealed to public gaze in order to enrich the misappropriator. For example, if you had in your youth had a certain notoriety which you feel you have lived down now and you would much prefer to forget it and not to have anyone know about it, if you find that this story with your picture is splashed before the public, you probably will feel indignant and hurt. How would you act also, how would you react if you found that your deceased husband's or parents' picture had been used to advertise a cigar? This has actually happened. Who owns the publishing rights for private correspondence? Is it the author of the letter, the recipient of the letter? Does anyone else who happens to get hold of these letters have the right to publish them without your consent? Interspersed in this book between the descriptions of legal cases are key legal opinions of various courts. For example, the theory of the right of privacy, which appeared in the Harvard Law Review in 1890. Apparently this is the first article which raised the question about the right of privacy in the United States. I can't go into detail, of course, in a short report, but there is the sad plight of Abigail. This is a very famous case. I suppose most of the lawyers know it, although the title is The Rochester Folding Box Company versus Roberson. In 1902, this company published Abigail Roberson's picture in 25,000 lithographic prints. They used it on a flower company's advertising without her or her parents' consent. She claimed that she was very much discommoded and made ill by this, and she sued the company for $15,000 and tried to prevent them from continuing to use her picture. Abigail lost by a 4-3 vote in the New York Court of Appeals. But the minority in this case, as sometimes happens, the minority opinion was not lost sight of. The New York Times picked up the case and called Judge Parker, one of the majority judges' opinion, that she had no damages coming, found this opinion amazing, and they wrote quite an article about it. They cited in their editorial of August 19-2 the case of a young woman in Newport whose portrait was flaunted in all the illustrated newspapers for no other reason than that she had at one time been betrothed to a young gentleman who committed suicide in circumstances necessarily very painful and horrible to her, and rendered far more so by this wanton invasion of her privacy and grief. And the Times then asked the question, if that young woman had happened to be the daughter of Judge Parker, we are of the opinion that the judge might reconsider. However, one of the other majority judges in this case replied to the New York Times editorial in the Columbia Law Review, pointing out the obvious irony of a newspaper championing, of all things, the right of privacy. Here's a difficult dilemma for our panel. A natural right of privacy inevitably tends to curtail the liberty of speech and press. As I say, if I understand Ernst and Schwartz properly, this is a very significant case. Roberson versus Rochester Folding Box. Even Judge Parker, speaking for the majority, suggested that the right of privacy might be properly protected if there were an act of the legislature passed. And at the very next session in 1903, the New York State Legislature did pass the Privacy Law of 1903. This law was tested for its constitutionality by the Rhodes case, which came up in 1908. And in this case, all seven judges were united and stood firm, agreeing that the law was constitutional because it is the essence of laws passed by the legislature that they do not have to follow prior judicial decisions. In other words, Abigail lost her case in part because there were neither precedents nor statutes which could be used by the court in deciding her case. Later citizens did have the protection of a New York statute. The modern concept of the right of privacy is still developing, of course. You have in your hands a bibliography compiled by a young colleague of mine, Richard Hemming. I'm sorry he cannot be here today. He has done this whole job of compiling the bibliography, and then because I was very busy, he told me which books to read, and I read these that you see here. And I'm going to comment on only one more book, a special case, the Brooks Annotated Bibliography. There is a peculiar value to this book for civil libertarians who are interested in conducting educational campaigns about civil liberties in general and about the invasion of privacy. Especially valuable in this bibliography is the section of fiction, novels which have as a theme some civil liberties principle. And also particularly valuable is the section on audiovisual material, listing films and film strips and other materials of that nature. Both Mr. Hemming and I were disappointed in in a way, in the American Scholar articles, which are listed here, the authors seem to talk around the subject rather than directly to the issue. Nevertheless, they do have one value, and this is that they do not simply react to all the phenomena that Ernst and Brenton and Packard are talking about. They don't react by assuming immediately that all the horrible examples in these popular books are necessarily and under all circumstances evil. So there's a little bit of a restraint here in the American Scholar articles. Finally, although it's not on the list, if you've not read George Orwell's 1984, you really cannot appreciate the fact that he might more appropriately have used the title 1964 insofar as the electronic supervisory devices are concerned. In fact, they are beyond his inventiveness in one way. Big Brother watched Winston Smith, the hero of 1984, the professional distorter of history. Big Brother watched him all the time when his light was on in his room by a TV set. Today, the snoopers have actually perfected a camera which by infrared takes pictures in the dark. So poor Winston today wouldn't even be spared the invasion of his privacy in the dark.
That was Dr. David K. Berninghausen speaking on the literature available in Invasion of Privacy. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of MCLU. If you are interested in obtaining a printed copy of the bibliography setting forth the materials discussed in this presentation, send your name and address to Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And now we hear from Professor John R. Ellingston, a criminologist at the University of Minnesota Law School, discussing the problem of invasion of privacy by our social and welfare agencies.
In discussing some of the invasions of privacy in the practices of welfare departments and other public agencies, I want to begin with a warning. This problem is not one of finding culprits. It is not a problem of lining up the bad people over there so that we good people can shoot them down. Indeed, as we shall see later, if we follow such an attempt through to its logical conclusion, we good people will find ourselves looking into the other end of the rifle. Actually, some invasions of privacy in our complicated, populous, urbanized, interdependent, affluent, and humanitarian society, I hope all those adjectives are justified, are the outgrowth of these very features. Take public housing. I'm indebted to one of my good friends, a social worker in the city, for this illustration. He quotes one mother's statement made in a group meeting of public housing parents, residents, parents living in public housing. Quote, "I used to live here before they tore this neighborhood down," said the good lady. "It wasn't any picnic then, believe me, but at least you didn't have so many people around bothering you all the time. This public housing isn't bad, but how can you ever keep away from anyone here?" End of quote. Perhaps in the physical and social planning for the poor, and this of course is the crucial problem we're dealing with, we are focusing too much on opportunities for interaction between people, a sense of community and neighborhood feeling, and not enough on opportunities for privacy. But it isn't a simple problem. How urgent the development of a sense of community in our atomized societies is revealed by the widespread feeling of isolation, of not belonging, of enmity among our urban citizens, particularly the poor. Many of the invasions of privacy by welfare workers grow out of their sense of responsibility towards the child who is their client. For example, A worker supervising a neglected child in a foster home may permit the child's natural parent, whose influence on the child has been bad, to visit the child only in the worker's office and in his presence. Is this an invasion of the father's privacy? In one instance, a worker went so far as to cut off the father's right of visitation in the belief, he said, that the court would soon terminate the father's parental rights. He was overstepping, of course. His concern was for what he believed to be the best interest of the child. A similar overriding concern for the welfare of children lies behind the pressure workers and agencies usually put on the mothers of illegitimate children to put their child up for adoption. That's, of course, a problem involving the rights of parents rather than invasions of privacy. It should be pointed out that almost always the illegitimate child's future will be served better by adoption. This illustrates the difficulty, the two issues which in the rights or invasion of privacy with which we have to deal, or to try to balance. Two practices urged upon workers responsible for the supervision of children adjudged delinquent have slipped over into welfare agencies' practices with clients not involved in violations of the law. One practice is the tendency on the part of social workers to hold interagency conferences about clients. An interagency conference, of course, is a mutual exchange of all the information, some of it very damaging, that the particular agency has on a client to the other agencies. In some cases, this is done with the complete knowledge and understanding of the client, but generally, of course, it isn't. In any event, my informant in this case said that he knew of no instance where the client has requested this, nor is the client usually really asked to give his permission in the sense of having a true option of either turning this down or accepting it without feeling, realistically or unrealistically, pressures from the agencies. The second practice is that of calling it the home of welfare clients without advance warning. Dropping in unexpectedly is likely to give a more realistic picture of home life than if the client knows you are coming, and thus can be an advantage to the agency in diagnosing the problem, knowing what really is going on in terms of the children, in terms of the family. This is a rather common practice among social agencies, social workers, justified either on a diagnostic basis or on a reality basis. For example, many low-income families have no phones through which appointments can be made. This means extra work, an additional visit, or letters to the client. The evils to which this practice have given rise in many parts of the country, and which I will discuss at the end, have led the Hennepin County Welfare Department, for example, to lay down a rule forbidding any visit without advance warning to the client that you're coming at a certain time. The balance between protection of the welfare of children and adults and invasion of privacy is not always easy to strike. Welfare departments often have problems with recipients of old age benefits living in their own homes who are too old to take care of themselves but who refuse to move and refuse help. They won't respond to offers of help, but they're not violating any ordinance or any law, and there's no basis for a petition. One such case, or two such cases, you remember a couple of years ago, the Milhanner family, I think, the two blind piano tuners who lived in their own home or where they had lived for years, that had gotten pretty feeble, but they just refused to move, refused to accept any help. The county welfare department sent an agent once a week to visit them and to offer help and so on. On one occasion, he arrived, of course, and found that they had both died by freezing. Their water system had failed to work. Their heating system had broken down. This was the result. Well, how far can you go in insisting upon action by people against their will, against whom you can find no legal basis for action? The conflict between welfare and the right to privacy creates more serious difficulties in the area of neglect. The welfare department, anywhere, any city, of course, any state, gets a complaint from the school or some other agency or person that certain children are neglected. To get information that will justify a petition in court or to disprove the complaint, welfare has to interview the neighbors, the school, and any other possible sources of information. Certainly such steps, as Mr. Berninghausen pointed out, are an invasion of the parents' privacy. And if there's no justification, you've got the neighbors stirred up and all the rest of it with all the harm that that entails. On the other hand, to avoid that, are we going to sacrifice the children? Social workers, and I think those of you familiar with this field, will know that the general and I think provable impression is that vast numbers of children in our urban communities are truly neglected, but about whom no action is taken because of the difficulties that I've hinted at here. The most flagrant invasions of privacy in the welfare field are unquestionably the so-called midnight raids. The unannounced inspections of the homes of persons receiving public assistance often aid to dependent children mothers. Professor Charles A. Reich of Yale Law School wrote an article on the subject for the Yale Law Journal of June 1963, and I am indebted to his article for the following information. In many states, these raids are made without a warrant and in the middle of the night. Their purpose is, of course, to check on the eligibility for assistance and to determine whether a recipient is cheating. In ADC cases, of course, the presence in the house of an adult male capable of supporting the family renders the mother ineligible. The searches are sometimes based upon particular evidence known to investigators beforehand, but on occasion there have been mass raids designed as general checks on eligibility. This is very much like the practice that in New York a number of years ago when I was living there, ordering an arrest of all vagrants or of everybody that the police suspected might be bums of one kind or another. Mass raids, just to determine whether of welfare, of ADC mothers in their homes, to determine whether they were cheating. The demand for entry may carry with it the threat, express or implied, that refusal to admit will lead to discontinuance of public assistance. This was widespread, as I said, in the Department District of Columbia, and many states have been doing this. And this Professor Reich demonstrates that such raids violate the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable searches and seizures, which is enforceable against the states through the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. Among other things, he points out that unannounced visits to determine eligibility for funds may actually result in criminal prosecutions. Here's a raid without a warrant, said to be to determine eligibility, which results in a criminal prosecution. Like the police of the totalitarian countries, and I lived for 2 years in Russia in 1921 and 23 and know what this means, investigators close in on front and rear entrances of homes in the early morning hours. Professor Reich cites one case, a 1961 California case, People v. Phipps, in which a woman obtained welfare payments for herself and her 9 minor children after stating that her husband was absent from home and that she was seeking a divorce. After accumulating considerable evidence that the husband was actually living at home, investigators paid a nocturnal call described by the court as follows, quote, between 2 and 3 a.m. on January 28, 1959, investigators went to the Phipps home to investigate the truth of reports that Mr. Phipps was frequenting the home of Mrs. Phipps. The call was made at that unusual hour to preclude the anticipated explanation that Mr. Phipps was at the home for the purpose of visiting his children. As the investigators approached the home, they encountered Mr. Phipps as he came out the back door. Mrs. Phipps and several of the children were inside the home. Both Mr. and Mrs. Phipps were fully dressed. She stated that Mr. Phipps had spent the evening there and they were still visiting and awaiting the return of a teenage daughter who had gone out to attend a dance. primarily on the basis of a subsequent admission, but also on the basis of this evidence, husband and wife were convicted of grand theft. Professor Reich's article appeared, as I said, in June of 1963. To those law professors here, it is encouraging to discover how powerful the ivory tower of the law school can be. In the spring of 1964, the board of directors of the National Association of Social Workers, and this, I think, was largely stimulated by the blaze that this article created, adopted a statement on midnight raids from which I would like to read very briefly. Appropriate, midnight raids. After summarizing the nature of midnight raids, it reads, the National Association of Social Workers is deeply concerned about the way in which midnight raids may constitute a violation of the civil rights of welfare recipients and make it difficult for the social worker to aid his clients to improve social functioning. NASW's concern, therefore, embraces legal, ethical practice and administrative implications of the midnight raids. The question of whether such raids infringe the constitutional rights of citizens is being pursued through legal channels. For the individual social worker, however, the midnight raid poses other serious problems. He may be charged with unethical behavior if he is accused of being party to such an action, or he may be penalized if he refuses to be a participant. Lose your job if you don't follow through on one of these. It should be noted that NASW has procedures designed to protect a member who is fired and so on under such circumstances. NASW is also concerned with the climate of public opinion affecting those who receive public assistance. In many ways, the midnight raids are but a symptom of this climate, and this, I think, is fundamental. To counter this basic problem, NASW engages and joins in efforts to develop public understanding of the total public assistance program and to upgrade standards of service within it. Where a social worker has information that leads him to believe that a client is perpetrating a fraud on the public welfare department should be turned over to the proper law enforcement authorities. Welfare workers should not be policemen, is what it says. I think there's a more fundamental solution than that one. In the section of this that I've just read, dealing with the climate of public opinion in which welfare operates, the NASW has, I think, touched the heart of the problem. What welfare inevitably deals with is the poor, and what we are here discussing is the invasions of the privacy of the poor. For the recipients of welfare services are obviously poor. It is this very fact of poverty that invites, nay, even compels, invasions of privacy. Those bureaucrats who are guilty of the invasions are, with occasional exceptions, no more than the agents of what remains of the Protestant ethic, which saw poverty as a sin to be punished or to be ashamed of. Compelled by the residue of this ethic, which is still widely held by legislators and the power groups in our society, and by us, the more affluent group generally, welfare administrators and workers tend to look upon the poor as clients rather than citizens, in the phrase that Monrad Paulson used. And what rights do clients have? You notice that in the statement here we're talking constantly about clients, and it's so easy to give the poor, who are recipients of public aid of one kind or another, that they're a little less than citizens. And it's so easy for those who distribute it to feel that they're a little also, that they are a little less than citizens. The culprit then is, the culprit in this whole problem, in most instances, is the attitudes and values held by us who set them. And these must change if the president's war on poverty is to have any chance of success. Attitudes do change, of course. 100 years ago, many people regarded blindness as a punishment for sin, and feared that it was caused by contagious diseases. Consequently, the blind were spurned and rejected. If they survived, they did so in the main as beggars. We've learned better, of course, and we treat the blind as victims of misfortune who require support and care and so on. But the attitude towards poverty changed more slowly. Don Shapiro of the University of Michigan Law School, in a very witty speech in Washington last week, made this statement. Quote, in 1900, poverty was considered one of the essentials of the social system. And that's 100 years after we had this attitude about the blind. Had President McKinley declared a war on poverty, they probably would have declared a war on President McKinley, in terms of, which is a very vivid measure of the change of public attitudes in 64 years. Welfare was largely a problem for the church and the friendly local pastor. He would be sure that the poor received spiritual inspiration, assuring them that in the afterlife to come, all would be made up to them if they were honest and sincere. If they were not, they deserved what they got anyway. We have come a great distance since 1900, as the president's war on poverty currently demonstrates. But the greatest block still in the way of action is, I believe, that old bulwark of the Protestant ethic, the fact or the belief, because it's no longer a fact, that there is just not enough material goods for everybody and some have to suffer. Perhaps in the discussion later we can explore that more fully.
That was Professor John Ellingston of the University Law School speaking on invasion of privacy by social and welfare agencies. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of MCLU. If you would like a copy of the bibliography on literature in this field prepared under the direction of Dr. David K. Berninghausen of the University Library School, send your name and address to Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. This has been a Minnesota Civil Liberties Union educational production.